Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oil went screaming past $132 a barrel today. Didn't stop at $133. Didn't stop at $134 either. Topped it after hours today. Crude's up more than $7 in just the past 2 days. But I bet you still can't tell me where all that money's going. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org. Marketplace entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 21st of May today, Wednesday. Great to have you with us. The same welcoming sentiments, though, did not hold true on Capitol Hill today. The Senate Judiciary Committee brought Big Oil to its long green witness table to talk about rising prices and their corporate profits. The questions and the answers were pretty much along the lines of what we've all heard before. Senators wanted to know whether the industry is doing all it can to keep prices low. The words windfall profit tax were uttered, by the way. Oil executives defended themselves by saying, in essence, hey, it's expensive to go out there and drill for all that stuff. What wasn't really discussed, though, was what seems to be a pretty basic question, if you ask me. Who's on the receiving end of the $130-whatever dollars a barrel it is that we're paying? Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon tried to find the answer.
Okay, so we're all grumbling that they've got us over a $133 barrel of oil. But do you wonder who they are? Who's pocketing that $133? Economist Philip Verleger watches the oil industry. He says the ultimate price is decided by traders in New York, London, and other global markets. There are no wellheads that read out in dollar signs. Instead, producers write contracts based on the prevailing price at a future date, when a Saudi shipment arrives in Houston, for example. The producer gets almost everything.
Saudi Arabia would be getting $126 today. The Canadians would be getting something like $125. The intermediaries might be getting a dollar or two, depending on their management of it. But most of the money is going back into the producer's pocket.
Verleger says that might leave a few dollars for the speculators, but the price is mainly determined by supply and demand. And oil industry analyst Stephen Shork says by the quality of the oil, not every barrel sells for $133.
A sweeter, lower sulfur will yield a greater premium relative to other streams of a heavier blend.
It's the sweeter variety that's in high demand right now because it makes more of the more profitable diesel fuel. Verleger argues that $133 a barrel oil won't sell if there's no buyer.
It has nothing to do with speculators. It has everything to do with the inability to make enough diesel fuel to meet the European, Chinese, Asian, and U.S. demand.
He says as long as that's the case, the producers can pocket what the market will bear. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There aren't many industries that have been hurt more by rising oil prices than commercial aviation. And American Airlines finally threw up its arms today and said, we can't take it anymore. It's going to retire dozens of older, less fuel-efficient planes, lay off thousands of people, and get this, charge passengers $15 to check even one bag. We called former Southwest Airlines CEO Howard Putnam to ask him whether this might be the beginning of the end of the big airlines. Mr. Putnam, good to have you with us.
Thank you, sir.
Well, what's the business model answer when it makes more sense to take your biggest asset and keep them on the ground instead of having them do what they're supposed to do?
It doesn't make any sense. And the only way you can keep them in the air is use very few kinds and types of airplanes. And if you want to try to make money, do it on the long hauls and the international. But the way that the legacy carriers, and by that I mean Uniteds, Americans, Deltas, et cetera, can survive is not the way they're currently doing business.
Well, if you were running American today, what would you do?
First of all, I would take a look at my overhead, my bureaucracy, my management structure, and see what I can do to thin that down to match what's happening right now in the real world. Two, I would do what they did today. I would put some airplanes on the ground. They've got, 300, I think, MD-80s that are fuel guzzlers, and you're going to have to raise the fares more. American's the only one that has not been through bankruptcy to cleanse themselves, and I give Mr. Arpey credit and the group that they've done it the honorable way, but somewhere down the road, if they're going to stay in business, they may have to consider that as well. Now, I would not start charging all of my customers $15 to check a bag. I think that will have negative consequences.
Customers are going to see that and say, well, heck, I'm going to fly United or Delta or whatever.
Well, I think the other guys, they all seem to follow each other. They'll probably do it too. But, think of the consequences. They've exempted the frequent business travelers. So now your pleasure travelers who come up, show up with their family at the ticket counter thinking, I got a good fare for the family, and now they say, okay, there's six of you. Each of you got to pay $15 a bag. That's $90. The lines are going to get longer and people unhappy.
What do you think would happen if instead of making this announcement today, American had come out and said, you know what, we simply can't do business this way with low fares and oil where it is. All our ticket prices are going up $125 right now.
As an alternative to nickel and diming us, I think it would be a better customer service approach. I believe the general public would rather say, give it to me now. Give me one dose. I'll make a decision whether I'm going to fly or not, but don't nickel and dime me.
Is this really sort of the end of an era in aviation? Are these legacy carriers now just doomed?
I think it's another cycle. When we took Braniff through bankruptcy back in the 80s, Eastern disappeared, Western disappeared, National disappeared. An era changed then. And, if you said in 2 to 3 years, would all these named carriers still be here? I would probably say no.
Howard Putnam's been in airlines for a long, long time. He used to run Southwest, Braniff, too, if you remember them. Mr. Putnam, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Crude's not the only commodity in the news, of course. There was another dismal outlook on food prices this week from the World Bank, on rice in particular. Those prices have given rise to some protectionist tendencies, but supply shortages in Asia have forced Japan and some other big rice producers to reconsider their recent export bans. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
In a region of severe rice shortages, Japan is the exception. Inside a series of vast air-conditioned warehouses, the country has amassed about 1.5 million tons of imported rice, mostly from the U.S. The reserve has its roots in a World War II rice shortage that traumatized the nation. But with rice prices nearly tripling over the last year, Japan's emergency reserve is starting to look a lot more like hoarding.
We have to be really careful not to talk ourselves into a panic about food prices, because there is enough food in the world provided we manage it properly.
That's Simon Maxwell with the London-based Overseas Development Institute. He says releasing even some of that rice, as Japan is now considering, would help ease prices, especially in places where the poor spend up to 80% of their income on food. The World Bank is calling on exporters to release up to 1 million tons of rice. Vietnam, the world's second largest rice exporter, said today it may lift its recent ban on overseas shipments. And Japan has already agreed to sell some of its surplus to the Philippines. But Harvard University economist Ken Rogoff calls these fixes the political equivalent of a gas tax holiday.
It's a gesture that does clearly aim to please particularly poorer people, but it's very, very temporary. It's not a big gesture.
Rogoff says hoarding may be partly to blame for rice's record price tag, but he says the fundamental problem remains. Global demand for nearly every major commodity has outstripped supply. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve released the minutes of its most recent meeting today, and they only added to the oil-induced foul mood in the equity markets. Mr. Bernanke and the gang at the Federal Open Market Committee said their rate cut at the end of last month was a, quote, close call, as in it almost didn't happen. Also, that inflation and rising unemployment are still making him nervous. All in all, then, just not such a good day at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We will have the details when we do the numbers. As big oil was getting raked over the coals by the Senate Judiciary Committee today, the House was voting to renew billions of dollars in tax breaks for clean energy, like solar and wind. The bill also includes a specific credit for biodiesel. Supporters are pushing the plant-based alternative fuel as a cleaner way to wean us off petroleum products. But Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk that there's a loophole that's giving the biodiesel subsidy a bad rap.
Congress passed the biodiesel tax credit in 2004 to encourage U.S. production and consumption of this alternative fuel. Biodiesel is usually sold as a blend, say 20% modified soybean oil, 80% conventional diesel. The U.S. currently subsidizes biodiesel to the tune of a dollar a gallon. Trouble is, Congress had no idea how far some would go, literally, in order to take advantage of that subsidy.
I said, you got to be kidding me. That can't be accurate.
That's House Republican John Shattuck of Arizona. He's talking about his initial reaction when he found out about the so-called splash and dash scam. It's a perfectly legal practice, but critics say it exploits the biofuel subsidy and rips off American taxpayers. Here's how it can work. A tanker with a shipload of, say, Malaysian biodiesel stops at an American port. The foreign-made fuel is then blended or splashed with a token percentage of U.S. diesel.
The way the law is now is all of that product is able to qualify for the blender's credit.
Biofuels analyst Rick Kement says the tanker usually dashes off to Europe, currently the world's biggest market for biodiesel. There, the fuel is ultimately sold to European drivers, often below European prices because it's benefited from an American subsidy. Congressman John Shattuck.
As soon as the American taxpayers realize that they are paying out hundreds of millions of dollars to lower the price of diesel outside the United States, I think they're going to go, that's outrageous.
Also outrageous, perhaps, is the increase in greenhouse gases from all this shipping, say critics. According to European officials, a few European companies are even shipping their own biodiesel destined for their own domestic markets to the U.S. first. That way they take advantage of the subsidy. It's called the U-boat trade because the ships make such quick stops in U.S. ports. Congress has been struggling to shut down the loophole. Today, the House voted to extend the biodiesel tax credit, but also impose certain restrictions. Manning Farachi speaks for the American biodiesel industry.
What the bill does is it says that fuel produced outside the United States for use outside the United States does not qualify for the biodiesel tax incentive. So that would effectively shut down a splash and dash transaction.
Some splash and dash critics, like Congressman Shattuck, want to go further. He wants to limit the subsidy to biodiesel consumed in the U.S. That would hurt American biodiesel exporters, of course, but Shattuck says Europe's already furious over U.S. biofuel subsidies. Producers there say the U.S. subsidies are driving some of them out of business. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Among the many questions macroeconomists like to sit around and chew on is this one. Why do some countries have economies that grow and others simply don't? A commission set up in part by the World Bank has been trying to find the answer to that one for the past couple of years. Today, the group recommended, among many other things, heavy investment in infrastructure. Commentator Robert Rice says that's exactly what the United States ought to be doing, too.
From the 1930s through the 1970s, we assumed that the biggest economic challenge was to avoid recession or depression, and we came to rely primarily on government spending to keep the pump primed and demand up. Richard Nixon declared in 1971, "We are all Keynesians now," and he was almost right. But then came the late 1970s, and inflation became a bigger threat than recession. It was running at double digits when Fed Chief Paul Volcker put a brake on it by hiking interest rates so high he almost broke the economy, too. From then on, we assumed monetary policy was more important than fiscal policy. But now the biggest challenge, as it was before the 1970s, is lack of demand. Consumers don't have enough money in their wallets to keep the economy growing, and the Fed is stuck. If it cuts interest rates much further, it risks pushing the dollar lower. But that will spur inflation, as everything we buy from abroad costs more. So we've got to go back to fiscal policy, big time. The tiny checks the Treasury just sent out are barely enough to pay our rising fuel bills. We need a stimulus package that's truly up to the job of restoring aggregate demand. And the best and easiest candidate is spending on the nation's crumbling infrastructure. We've deferred billions of dollars of maintenance on bridges, sewers, water systems, levees, and dams. That's already cost the nation dearly. Now, the problem is the public doesn't trust the government to spend money on infrastructure wisely when earmarks go to bridges to nowhere. So here's the deal. The next president establishes a capital budget that lists infrastructure projects in order of priority. No more earmarks. The capital budget will reflect the nation's true infrastructure needs. And the government would fund that capital budget the way capital budgets should be funded, through borrowing that assumes a realistic return to those capital investments, just like any smart business does. That way, we keep the economy growing, create millions of jobs, and we get the infrastructure we need for the 21st century. It's a win-win-win.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book is called Super Capitalism. Send us your thoughts, no matter what you call them. Go to marketplace.org and then click on the link that says Contact. Coming up, when getting the story is just half the battle.
It's no longer just about putting an article in the newspaper. It's now also updating a blog, assigning videos, writing TV scripts.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street was in a mood today. People, the Dow Industrial slid 1.75%, 227 points to close at 12,601. The Nasdaq also gave up 1.75%, 43 points to end at 2448. The S&P 500 lost 1.6%, 22 points to finish at 1390. Financial stocks hit the floor after the Fed said it expects slower growth for the rest of the year. Citigroup off 4.75%. J.P. Morgan Chase lost almost 3%. Shares fell 2.8% at Merrill Lynch. Another record day for oil prices grounded airline stocks. United sheared off almost 30%. AMR nosedived 24%. That's parent company of American Airlines. So I guess so much for $15 a bag. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. And by Clarkson Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. The National Federation of Independent Business holds a forum on the future of healthcare reform. The Labor Department releases its weekly report on initial jobless claims. And the man with the famous whip and hat comes riding onto the big screen again. Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull opens to audiences nationwide. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is no such thing as a risk-free walk down Wall Street. You can get the next best thing, though, if you stick to what are called AAA-rated investments. Those are the credit ratings that Moody's and S&P hand out to companies or bonds that they have theoretically evaluated. That theoretically was in there on purpose because we saw this item in the Financial Times today. The paper says a computer glitch at Moody's gave one immensely complicated kind of mortgage-backed security, that coveted AAA, when it should have been rated much lower. And then Moody's kept it there for a year. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Moody's cut the ratings of these exotic securities early this year when the market turned south. It says it's reviewing what happened last year. Marilyn Cohen is president of Envision Capital Management. She wonders whether we'll hear more stories like this.
I have no confidence to believe it's just a one-off. I mean, all this time later, we find out now, as a credit meltdown is still evolving, this business model that they have is broken.
She says the ratings agencies need to operate in a much more transparent way. Gary Schilling is an economic consultant and investment advisor. He's not surprised the computer glitch and its consequences got pushed under the carpet. After all, he says they occurred when the market for such products was still healthy.
The reality is that when a speculation is running on the upside, nobody really cares much about anything that is going to discredit it. Everything is viewed optimistically.
The agencies are already under attack. Schilling says there's a conflict of interest when agencies are paid by the banks whose products they rate. And he says they overrated many subprime securities. He says this revelation is another blow to their reputation. And he thinks they'll try to make up for it by going overboard in the other direction.
Now they are going to join all the other negative forces in saying no to even very credible securities. In other words, their first instinct is going to be to downgrade, not to upgrade.
And that, he says, could rattle the whole bond market, which is much bigger than the stock market. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Investors downgraded Moody's itself today. Shares fell 16% after that little boo-boo. The balancing act between happy workers and the corporate bottom line can be a tricky one, so both sides are trying to find mutually agreeable solutions. Increasingly, the answer lies in flex time, letting employees work within limits when they want. It doesn't cost companies anything in actual cash on the barrelhead. It can improve morale, and it is becoming more of the norm. According to a study out today from the Families and Work Institute, more than three-quarters of companies now offer flex time. That's up 10% from a decade ago. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
These days, employers have no choice about offering workers more choices. Listen to financial analyst Janice Pappas. The 22-year-old didn't even apply for a stressful, though lucrative, investment banking position.
I was interested in being there till 2 or 3 in the morning, and I knew that was part of the job.
Pappas decided normal hours were more important than money. Attorney Linda Wong came to the same conclusion after the birth of her second child.
The flexibility is worth more than anything material.
Wong left a law firm for a temp job at a nonprofit. The Families and Work Institute survey found that nonprofits generally offer the best benefits. Everyone wants flexibility. Young workers expect it. Baby boomers want to phase in retirement by working reduced hours. Of course, flex time is more of a challenge for some businesses, like call centers. Shannon DeBerry is an HR expert at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Because you need somebody to answer that phone, so you have to be a little more creative.
The creative solution for airlines like Continental let some ticket agents work from home. Ellen Galinsky is president of the Families and Work Institute. She says more employers started offering flex time after they lost key workers.
They were leaving because they just couldn't manage their life in the way that they were working.
Employers are less flexible in some areas. Galinsky's study says 47% allow employees to go back and forth between full and part-time work. That's down from 57% in 1998. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Today seems to be the day for stories about entire industries in existential crises. We talked about airlines earlier. Newspapers are in just as much trouble, maybe more. Circulation's not just declining, it's plummeting. Same for ad revenue. Thousands of reporters and editors have lost their jobs. So how are newspapers surviving? Marketplace's Elisa Roth looked into it.
It's taken years for the newspaper industry to realize it's no longer really in the newspaper business. It's in the information business.
There's a certain content model, there's a certain revenue model, there's a certain production model, there's a certain business model. And the overwhelming tendency still is to say, how do we figure out how to replicate a model that worked for a century online?
Scott Anthony is president of the consulting company Innosight. By the way, Innosight has done a lot of work with the newspaper business, but wasn't directly involved in any of the changes you'll hear about in this piece. Anthony says the industry's finally coming around to the idea that printing a newspaper online is not the solution. Instead, it needs to find a new model. Take the Journal News, a paper that covers the suburban counties north of New York City, the kind of hometown paper most people read. It's owned by Gannett, the chain that owns USA Today. There, as at other Gannett papers, the big move has been toward local news. Not just local in the sense of focusing on, say, the city of White Plains, but what the company calls hyperlocal. Henry Freeman's the editor there.
We've gotten pretty aggressive here at Community Conversation.
That means creating ways, such as online forums and discussion boards, for readers to participate in the coverage, and then actually paying attention to what readers are saying, which Freeman says has changed the paper's coverage.
It's made us realize stories that we thought were over and done with, that there's still an interest in them. It's made us sometimes realize something that we're still think is a big story really has died down out there, and there's not a lot new in it.
What readers are talking about plays a big role in the stand-up huddles that have replaced the old-style morning meeting, which instead of being just a couple of editors, now includes anybody in the newsroom who's interested in chiming in. But chat rooms and discussion boards are just one part of the paper's other brave new strategy. Diana Costello is the paper's education reporter.
It's no longer just about putting an article in the newspaper. It's now also updating a blog, assigning videos, writing TV scripts, producing your own videos for the blog, and really just looking at the story from as many different angles as you possibly can to make it as rich for the viewer or the reader.
The paper also produces a couple of glossy magazines and a TV show. The multi-platform approach, as the paper calls it, also makes it easier to go hyper-local. The Journal News, for example, has extensive coverage of the local Little League and will cover every one of the 90-odd graduations in the area this spring. All of this has changed the old product, the daily paper. Breaking stories, like a freak windstorm that passed through the area late one afternoon, taking down power lines and trees, end up being covered on the web. What appears in the print edition tends to be more analysis and less news story. The ad model's changing, too. The company's been selling ads across all platforms rather than just for the print edition, something editor Freeman says advertisers appreciate. And he says readership's up, not just online, but in print, too. Of course, Gannett's is not the only model out there. And that, says Innosight's Scott Anthony, is really the new model.
Even when it becomes clear what a winning model will look like, don't expect that to last more than 3 or 4 years.
The new model for the industry, he says, is the need for constant innovation and perpetual reinvention. Because even if a paper figures it out once, if it doesn't know how to change, it might get it wrong the next time. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, not that the deeply troubled mortgage lender Countrywide needed any more bad press, but CEO Angelo Mozzillo has fallen victim to that oldest of computing faux pas, hitting reply instead of forward. Mozzillo got an email from a customer in danger of losing his home not too long ago, said the terms of his loan weren't made clear to him when he signed. The language was taken from a website that hundreds of people have apparently used for help when writing to Countrywide. Mozzillo doesn't much care for that, it seems. He replied to the gentleman in question, all the while thinking he'd only forwarded to some colleagues, and he called the note disgusting. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow erased 227 points, 1.75%. The NASDAQ slid 43 points, also 1.75%. The S&P 500 tumbled 22 points, 1.6% there. Robbie Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, taking a trip with a small carbon footprint.
I came to a little realization, why keep going all over the world when you've got what you want right in your backyard?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.